What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another Whiskey, Web, and Whatnot, your favorite podcast about whiskey, web, and whatnot, with your hosts, Robbie the Wagner and Charles William Carpenter III, with our guest today, Jonathan Creamer, who I hear loves milk. Is that true?
That is a false statement. I switched to oat milk a while ago. I prefer it way more in my lattes.
Is that still considered a creamer, even though you are?
We do oat milk creamer now as well, too. But that's a good question. But, I mean, creamer has been non-dairy for a while. Like, if you go up and down the aisle, it's been non-dairy creamer. So it doesn't have to have milk in it, I guess.
I don't want to go too far down this path, but don't you find that to be an oxymoron a little bit?
It does, I guess. It's maybe sort
no
of
no cream
like,
whatsoever.
Maybe it's like it's the Kleenex sort of like, it's just like a brand. It's just creamer. It's just creamer no matter what's it's like made out of. I don't know.
Yeah. Like the Hoover used to be the vacuum regardless of brand. Hey, well, I'm going to Hoover this.
Yeah. Exactly.
That was just in the 50s when I was growing up. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Before the internet. Anyway, yeah, let's actually go back to what we're actually here for. Do you want to give a few sentences about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So Jonathan Creamer, and I'm a senior software engineer at Microsoft. I'm a company man. I love my swag. Call me Swagamemnon. I literally bought my Ford Fusion in 2011 because it had Microsoft Sync in it. So it's like how long I've been wanting to work for this place.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I've been my third year at Microsoft. Or I guess it'll be three in February. And I do JavaScript tooling stuff. My team at Microsoft is called OneJS, and we maintain the engineering system for building Office web, basically, and lots of different little widgets you find across the Microsoft 365 suite. So we have this big monorepo with about, I don't know, 700 or 800 engineers monthly contributing to it. I'll go away from my computer for 2 days and do a git pull and have 1,000 commits. Like, it's just that much. It's a lot going on. So it's cool. My team is spread kind of across the world. I'm in Nashville, but I've got folks in Redmond, obviously, in Vancouver, all the way into Oslo, Africa, India. It's a team of about 50 engineers that maintain our system. I've been doing this here for 2.5 years. Before that, I was Eventbrite doing something similar for an infrastructure. I really got into developer tooling over the last, I think, like 5-6 years. I started really enjoying engineers being my customers rather than relying on Google Analytics to tell me if people like my stuff. You know, I can ask developers how they like my stuff. It's just very fulfilling. So yeah, sort of me in a nutshell, I guess.
Nice. Cool. And you're remiss to leave one item off of your resume.
I am.
Which is the former interviewer of Charles William Carpenter III.
That is true, yes. Mm-hmm. If I keep going back in my employment history, there was a long stint I had at a travel company called Lonely Planet. That was actually where I fell in love with React. Before that, I was doing Backbone and jQuery, and then I started to switch from React into developer tooling. And yes, I guess during my tenure there, I interviewed you, which is what you said. Yeah. And I remembered it when you said, as soon as you said Nat Geo, that was, I think, what really kicked it into my mind. I was like, oh yeah, I remember the Nat Geo guy. I don't know what happened after that. We know we were hiring a lot of people back then, which is obviously why you forget, you know, all that stuff. But that is so funny when you said that. I've told everybody that, yeah, I'm on this podcast, and I guess I interviewed one of the hosts. Yeah. And I completely forgot and felt so bad about that. But no, it's cool.
Big and small world. Yeah. Well, it wasn't your fault, and I made it all the way through that process, and you can ask questions or not if you want. It doesn't matter to me. But I opted out of it.
Yeah. I see. Okay. Well, I wanted you to be there, if I recall correctly. So full circle, I guess. Here we are all together now.
Which brings us to our next question. Can you invert a binary tree for us real quick?
I can if I have Copilot enabled in my editor, and I can just like write a comment and say, write me a binary tree, and it can just do it.
That's fair enough.
That's true. ChatGPT can do that for us.
Tell us about the whiskey we got today.
Well, Robert, our whiskey today is the 13th Colony Distillery Southern Bourbon, 13th Colony Southern Bourbon. 95 proof, aged 4 to 6 years, a mash bill of 70% corn, 21% rye, and 9% malted barley. They are based in Americus, Georgia, which I thought was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't get any clarity as to like
Georgia?
If Americus.
Americus.
Yeah. Americus. So Anyway, and it kind of looks like the birthday bourbon.
It does. I wish it was, but this I'm sure is going to be just as good.
We don't have that kind of budget right now. So maybe Microsoft should sponsor this podcast.
Oh, there we go. We can see, we'll see what we can do here.
Yeah.
We'll say good things about TypeScript, we promise.
You better.
You say good things about it anyway. When you take a look at the... I mean, like, Microsoft gets a bad rap, I think, on the long term in some ways. Anyone who had to deal with Windows and IE battles kind of has a me about it, but they've done a lot of good stuff for us.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Chuck can be quoted from an episode saying
I know.
That Microsoft are the purveyors of everything terrible on the internet or something like that.
I was laughing when that tweet came out, and I was like, all right, this is going to be interesting, but hey, no, it's cool. It's cool. I can understand.
Listen, I said what I said.
Hey, we all have PTSD from IE6. It's okay. We can all exactly. we can all move past that together. Like,
yeah. And it was part of, you know, maybe I shouldn't admit this openly, but I certainly, way back in the day when I would build my own computers and stuff, I may or may not have paid for copies of Windows and then would complain when they would break often.
Yeah. I mean, I had a long stint on Mac as well. But to be fair, like, I work at Microsoft, but this is my work provisioned M1 Mac. I use it a lot. And this is my iPad Pro that I take Teams meetings on all the time. So I get to use whatever I want. But I also do like Windows 11 a lot. So I'll admit that. Yeah.
And it seems okay. Yeah, it seems okay. we'll put a pin in that. Let's come back to some Microsoft things. Yes. I don't only want to shit talk some things, but Teams is the fucking worst. Okay.
Oh, God. All right. Anyway, this whiskey.
Yeah.
It smells a little like powdered sugar to me.
I'm getting a little corn syrup.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little corn syrup on my... But I've had some allergies this week. It's been raining here, believe it or not.
Where?
I'm in Phoenix, I'm in the desert.
Phoenix, okay. Yeah. That is crazy.
Yeah. There's what they call a monsoon season. Other places would just call it rainy season. Mm-hmm. But more often. Yeah. Maybe I'm getting a little cola. Because I feel like I'm getting some corn syrup, but maybe it's a little more cola-ish. I'm going to taste it.
I'm tasting some mango.
I have a little caramel, maybe. I will admit, I'm really bad as you can see, I have a lot of whiskey behind me. Mm-hmm. And I know which ones I like, but I don't necessarily always know how they taste, but I know what I like, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, this is all a made up language anyway. I mean, all words are made up. These in particular, and assigned for this descriptor, is just us trying to come up with flavor words that we can sort of agree upon.
After listening to y'all's podcast for so long, I realize what I need to do, though, is I need to read what the flavor notes of a specific whiskeys are and then kind of learn how to, like, sort of like user story points, like do them relative to each other. Like, this one says it had a lot of vanilla. Maybe this is what vanilla is supposed to taste like in a whiskey.
Right. That's whiskey vanilla versus regular vanilla. So, okay, I'm getting a little like flat cherry Coke. And then a finish that has a slight lemongrass to me. Pretty light, but I'm getting a little like lemony lemongrass kind of. You know how like lemongrass almost has like a Windex like, quality to it,
like a lemon verbena. So,
did you say how long this was aged?
They said 4 to 6 years.
Okay, I could see it's got a little bit of a young taste, but not as some like I can tell when it's like just came like 4 years or like the bare minimum.
Yeah,
and this is not that. So they've moved past that stage.
And with such a high corn mash bill, if it was just 4, I would say you're going to get like a corn bomb, but you're getting a little more of the sugar syrup, like caramel side of it. So I'd say that tells you that's, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
It does lack some depth for me, though. You know, like I'm getting just these flavors here and then it kind of just goes away. 95%, I don't feel like it's got a lot of hug either.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
I'm going to give it one more taste and then I'll set up to your listener because there's one. the tentacle scale.
Yes, the tentacle scale, of course.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of sticking with it. I'm still getting a little lemon citrus finish, a little cherry cola start. Not bad. We'll see how it opens up. Alrighty. So, dear listener, as you may not know, we do a very simple, we are developers, so we can do a zero-based scale. 0 to 8 tentacles now are your options, because, hey, we're clever and an octopus has 8 tentacles. So 0 or 1 being horrible, I don't want this anymore. 4 being like, middle of the road, not a bad thing. And then 8, of course, being amazing. I'm going to clear the shelves every time I see this. And clear the shelves is like a little whiskey term of that's amazing. I found like the best deal, the greatest thing. They've got 8 bottles. I'm taking them all. So we'll start with Robbie. Let him do them.
I'm going to actually give this one a 7, I think, because I don't exactly know why, but in terms of bourbons, I'm not usually a good, like a big bourbon fan. Like I like rye and spicier stuff more, but this has a lot of different flavors going for it. And I don't know. I'm just feeling a 7.
I like it.
You do you. Jonathan, what do you think?
I was going to go 5. Now Robbie's swaying me a little bit more towards a 6, but I do love bourbon, and I have about probably 60 or so bottles in my house. And so like relative to the other 59 now, I think it's still good. I can't wait till I'm going to keep sipping on it for sure. And maybe I would buy another bottle one day. I think I would like to share it with a friend and say, hey, look at this really cool. I think I like the bottle and the presentation so much and sort of the story of it that I might even go to 6 for that reason alone, just to like keep it kind of on my shelf. Because it's going to draw, it doesn't look like the rest of the things. It's like got a different look to it. So,
yeah. Takes up double the room, though.
It does take up a little bit more room, but then that it's like a conversation piece, you know? It's like, hey, what is that thing?
Yeah.
I need to try that thing.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. I do like the story. I do like the bottle shape. And I would be interested to try some of their other expressions.
Yes.
Because I believe there were a couple of options. There's like a double oaked one and something else.
Yeah.
And I think something like that might bring out some additional like flavor profiles for me.
Yep.
I'm going to go with your original. Like it is kind of a 5 for me. I can't recall the cost. It wasn't like inexpensive, but it's not like crazy. I don't know. It must have been between 50 and 70 bucks.
Yeah.
I don't know. That'd be a pretty good guess. That's like all new distilleries, basically. Everything's $50 to $70.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no like entry level, you know, real thing into it. So I'm always a little annoyed with them around those things. But yeah, a decent story in general. Appreciate that like there's a lot more players in the space trying to push whiskey in different areas and experiment with it. And so who knows, you know, where that goes over time. But so for those reasons, and it's not bad, but I can't see it yet standing out for me where I'm like, oh guys, have you had this yet? Because it's really good. So it's a 5.
There's a store down here near me in Spring Hill called Elixir, and I'm in their Facebook group and they're always posting about stuff, and they've posted about the cask strength one. And it's a green bottle. I could see that being kind of interesting. Sometimes when they cut it, it's like you cut a little too much of the flavor out there. Like maybe at a higher proof I might like it even more.
Yeah. Maybe. I do like that. I want to get like the mash bill and like everything they were thinking of when they put it in the barrel initially.
Yeah.
I'm always interested to try it in that way. So that's one of the biggest reasons. And cask strength gives you so many more options too. Because it's high proof, you can kind of take a little nip then, and you're like, if you add a few drops or a cube, you're not like totally crushing it down and making it too watery. So,
yeah.
So I actually prefer that too. So it would be interesting to try more of them for sure.
I generally love cask strength or full proof or whatever, anything. Like it's funny when I try like an Irish whiskey or even like a Jack Daniels or something, it's like this has no, there's nothing to it. It's like, what am I doing? I'm like, I don't know if I've just burned all the flavor off of my tongue or something, and I can like only
it could
taste
be that.
High proof whiskey now. But
I don't know if you have the same heartburn issues that I do. Yeah,
I have a lot of heartburn issues, but whiskey is actually not one of the things that does it. Only tomato sauce. That's what nails me bad.
Oh well, it sounds like you got a few more years of just chugging the hard stuff, and then we'll see where that lands. But
Fair enough.
I mean. Cask strength, I think, is a very interesting way to try like a new distillery. And we're beholden to what certain places online will mail to us or what Robbie can get as his local ABC, unfortunately, because he decides to continue to pay taxes in the state of Virginia.
I see.
Lots of taxes. Yep.
Yeah.
Moved to Nashville.
They keep collecting
them. We've been to Nash Vegas.
Nashville's getting expensive.
Have you?
Too,
yeah.
Though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've obviously been.
Well, you have obviously been.
As I came. Yeah, well, Franklin, but also Nashville. Yeah, right before the pandemic, right? Or something?
No, during.
Did we do it during?
Like, oh, yeah, I think after everyone got vaccinated, like, and we felt safe for a little while, it was like during that time.
Where'd you guys go?
We were like, we're invincible.
Or what'd you do in Nashville?
I mean,
we.
Stereotypical things.
I forget the place we stayed. We stayed in like the.
The old train station. That's
Union Station.
Yes. Yep. That place is cool. Mm-hmm. Like historic buildings. Yes. Very cool. Obviously spent a little time on the main drag.
Yep.
And
Broadway.
We went to, Kid Rock's place, mm-hmm, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, feels like a daytime place to be. And then a couple, and the rooftop of Justin Timberlake's place.
12:30 Supper Club.
Yes.
Very cool spot.
Went up there. That was fun. And then there was like this place near us that had a bunch of games, and it was like bring your own food, and they had drinks there, and they had like the mini bowling. And
yeah, that's like Pins that. Mechanical. I was literally there this past weekend for my anniversary. It's an awesome spot.
It is. Yeah,
it's fun.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Nashville has a good new distillery too called Nashville Barrel Company, and they're starting to pop up in other areas. I saw Nashville Barrel Company in San Diego when I was out there in July. So look for Nashville Barrel Company stuff. They're usually single barrel picks are just really good. So
I was gonna say, do you know anyone in Nashville who would mail me a bottle?
I might be able to find it.
We went to Greenbrier.
That was something we learned of there.
Greenbrier's good. Yeah,
we like that.
There's a couple different little ones popping up. Leaper's Fork out in Franklin is another one that's just, and they actually just opened a brand new place called Stable Reserve in downtown Franklin on the main strip. So like we've got a lot of little distilleries popping up, but Nashville Barrel is one of my favorites.
Okay.
Could hook you up for that for sure.
Okay. We should check it out. I mean, I would check it out personally, and we could even do it on this podcast.
Yeah. I might have to come back for that one, I think.
Yeah. There you go. You'll be evangelizing. Then it'll be sponsored by both Microsoft and Nashville Barrel
Company.
All righty.
Yeah.
So then we
can afford to keep going.
All right. Well, let's dive into a few hot takes. Although I found a lot of tech Twitter to be somewhat lukewarm over the last week or so. I had a thing that was interesting this morning, but I'm getting older and I forgot things if I don't put it in notes. So, you know, it'll be what it is.
Is this even a thing that can be compared? I mean, you can ask this one. I don't understand.
Well, there's just a lot of talk about the first part, but then, you know, I'm just tying it into him personally. It's just called personalization, sure. Robbie. You should care about your craft. So what do you think, Flutter or Cold Fusion? You had to choose one to use for the rest of your life, Flutter or Cold Fusion?
I got my start with Cold Fusion. So I would go write some Cold Box MVC framework and write some CFCs all day long.
There you go. See, that's a hot take. Vision.
Oh yeah, it's still a thing. It's expensive though, man. God, I like got an advertisement for Adobe Cold Fusion the other day. It was like ridiculous what they're charging for it, but I did really like it back in the day.
Interesting. I think you're the first person I've heard that doesn't do it currently that liked it.
I loved it. Well, I wasn't doing like your typical just like CF dump, CF calendar, CF all the things thing. We used an MVC framework back in the day called Coldbox and did like, you know, controllers, models, views, and then did jQuery on the front end. And so it felt like any other back end way to query a thing. And, you know, we had DTOs. It was almost like Java, Cold Fusion, and then Backbone JS, jQuery on the front end. So, and this was 11 years
ago. JQuery's back now.
Did it ever go away?
No, that's a thing.
That's true. I guess
no, it did. It went away.
Well, we stopped using it, but I don't know that it went away.
Yeah. True.
There's definitely places. I know it exists in places here and there. So
I love jQuery.
Yeah.
Still.
So tying back to Microsoft with TypeScript.
Yes.
Do you use inferred types or explicit types?
I go mostly inferred and then make interfaces to make it like easier to discover like what my intent behind a type might be. I'm definitely not one of these that puts like, you know, the return type and const this colon string. Like I'll use infer most of the time. But if I have some options object that's getting to be too gnarly, I'll make that a type or an interface or something and stick it out in the export it so you can find it and know kind of what my head was at with that type or whatever. I think people can go very verbose and I don't really like that so much. So maybe kind of a middle ground, like infer the easy stuff. And then when you start getting into objects flying around, I'll probably type some stuff and use some cool generics and all those kinds of fun things. Try to use some of the tricky, fun magic types.
Yeah, there is definitely some magic.
I was reading about the infer keyword today. I still don't understand how it works, but it looks cool though. You can like magically infer.
I'm unfamiliar.
Yeah, there's like this new-ish thing God, I don't even know. I read an article about it this morning and I still can't explain it, but you can like magically figure out what a type inside a generic is. And they call it unwrapping a type using the infer keyword. Yes.
Okay. So it like takes the thing that you pass through and then like grabs it.
Somehow. Yeah, yeah. You can infer the return type of a thing through a generic. Like you use it with the extends. In combination with the extends keyword, you can infer something that you extended, something like that.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I don't get too complex. I'm learning new stuff every day, but
yeah,
definitely TypeScript over not typed.
Yeah, 100%. I remember back in the day when I was when CoffeeScript was still a thing. If you guys ever remember that one.
Oh yeah, I remember. I loved it.
Yeah. See, I didn't. I was like, oh, let's just write pure JavaScript. What do we need to like JavaScript's perfect. And really, even when TypeScript came out, when I was still, I guess, at Lonely Planet, I was not into it at all. And I was trying to tell everybody, just write JavaScript. There's no reason to like do all this work.
Yeah.
And then I realized after using VS Code for a year or two that somebody said, you realize that JavaScript is just going through the TypeScript compiler in VS Code and you're just writing TypeScript anyways. And I was just like, really?
You're like, well, I'm trapped. I might as well do it.
I may as well just throw some colons in here now, I guess, and call it a day. And then I became a huge TypeScript advocate.
Yeah. Well, I will regress and say that I did like CoffeeScript, but I was in the Django world with Python, and it felt kind of close. So it was like, I don't have these massive leaps, and you know, you could omit curlies.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. You were already in a curly-less world.
Yeah, so, you know, it felt more natural to work on both things.
Well,
so
but it kind of came from Ruby, didn't it? CoffeeScript, wasn't it like a Rubyism thing? If I recall correctly, I thought the guy that made it was like a big Ruby developer. And
well,
sort
that
of
I don't know.
Ruby to...
I didn't used to care about the Who. Remember when Who didn't really matter? Like, Who was just like behind the scenes, and you just talked about the what? Where, like, now people are more like the face of the what? And there's this whole Who that we talk to the Who's now. I don't know. I just feel like that has been a massive shift overall.
Well, I think it's helpful to have a good advocate, like in charge of a leader for the project that everyone can see. And you know, if they're charismatic, then the project takes off better. But
well, sure, I get that. But I probably used jQuery for like 4 or 5 years before I ever heard the name John Rezig. Right?
Yeah.
And then
people built jQuery.
Yeah,
there were people that did that.
I was just like, I don't know. I love these. I love being able to grab a thing and change it. That's all I want to do. And he makes it easy across browsers.
Yeah. So there's a lot of branding to things now.
Yeah.
I can see that.
All right. So controversy, because I don't know where you stand on this one. So this one I left in. Tailwind or vanilla CSS?
So this kind of goes, it's very reminiscent to me of like the same argument we have in the JavaScript community, which is like this frameworks versus, you know, not frameworks thing. And I think like if I want to make something fast and I don't care about getting into the nitty gritty, then I'll just grab Tailwind and throw it in, make a thing and be done with it. I made a thing. I think it's better to make a thing than it is to debate about how the thing was made in the first place. I would debate that, you know, and I know there's
would debate that is debatable.
I bet. I think most people would just say it depends.
Yeah. And I do think there's always the it depends factor, right? I mean, like, but I'm not against it. So there's that. There are people I know, like my friend Chris, who rakes Tailwind developers over the coals. So he's a hardcore
Chris,
CSS
don't be a
guy.
Dick. it's okay if you don't want to use it, Chris, though.
It's cool. But I do love, I've been getting back after listening to some episodes of you guys, hearing Chris Coyer talk about some of the view transition stuff and all those cool things coming. It's got me want to like kind of mess with some CSS again. I've been in DevOps tooling land for so long for the last 5 years that like I don't even remember the last, I don't even know if I could... If you held a gun to my head, I don't think I could like use Flexbox without like having to go read W3C articles for a few hours or something. Like it's just been that long since I've written CSS.
And for now, you can still reference CSS tricks until they continue to F up that site.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah.
Just give it back to Chris. He keeps his money and gets his site back.
I don't think that's how it works.
Well, but, I mean, you know. DigitalOcean's got money. They're okay.
Yeah, just, you know, we'll keep the links back to DigitalOcean. Can you let us, you know, own the content? Thanks.
Yeah, like, do, like, the syntax acquisition with Sentry. Like, You own it, but the people that were doing it right, that brought everyone to the thing, keep running the thing. That's how you keep it working.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And I don't want to get too much into Chris's business, but you know, also he was trying to focus on CodePen, right? So he was sort of journey's over. It's time for the next journey.
Yeah.
We'll see later. So there's that aspect of it. But I think the community as a whole having it or some version of it, there was a little bit of Twitter talk for a bit of like, how about we all get together and put like $10 a piece in and see if we can get it back?
Oh, get Rebase or get Merge?
Definitely a Rebase fan for sure. And a fan of the Squabasurge, the Squas Rebase and Merge into main. We used to call it that at Lonely Planet.
Oh, yeah.
Merge commits drive me bonkers, especially when I see somebody that had, you know, not a tremendously long running branch, but long enough to where they just like kept merging main into their branch over and over again. And then they just merge that thing in without squashing it. I'm just like, could you not have just, you know, not done that maybe and not made the Git history look just horrible? So yeah, I'm definitely a big Rebase fan, and it amazes me that I'm still having this conversation in 2023, to be honest with you. I kind of thought we settled that a long time ago. So yeah, definitely Rebase. And you know, when I was at Eventbrite, we had a script. It was like every morning people ran it and it rebased their branch on top of main. And so I guess I was just used to that. And then I didn't realize when I came here, that was actually a very unique thing that I want to do it here. People don't really take that for granted. You know, just rebase your branch every now and then you won't have problems in your PRs because you'll be on top of main more often, you know, and then you won't have weird merge issues. Just please rebase.
Yeah, that's definitely a caveat to a large organization with a lot of people, particularly when a lot of them are working within the same repos, is that the rules of engagement, the rules of how you decide to work, and if you don't want to utilize automation to enforce those, right? You want good citizens. You don't want to be like a police state. But then conversely, you, like you said, go away a couple of days, come back, there's thousands of commits already. Mm-hmm. Does that need to be tenfold because someone doesn't embrace the rules of engagement? That's a real back and forth controversial thing. It's like, it's annoying if I'm going to have like a 5-minute, commit hook locally, right? But then also, then do you offload those rules to CI? But then like your feedback cycles get, you know, so what's the trade-off there?
Yep.
It does kind of suck, but.
Definitely a Rebase fan. I don't know. I don't understand.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
People especially when merging PRs, like if you don't squash and merge, then it gets really gross. And it also like throws off statistics where people be like, oh, I had 5,000 commits in the last 6 months. Well, cool, but were they meaningful or was it like, save this, do this, trying if this works? Like,
well, and I like some people make the argument that like they don't rebase because they don't want to like lose the history of their pull requests. But I'm like, when you rebase, you can squash it down and you can write yourself a nice, pretty note that says what you did in your pull request. You get the whole, you know, maybe we need to teach people how to use Vim better or something. I don't know. Cause like I Vim and I'll go and I'll copy the note.
Oh, so you interactive rebase. So you're an advanced rebaser too.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that's the thing. Well, I think I take that for granted. Right. Like,
Well, maybe there should be a developer tool that does that automatically for you on a post, maybe like a post merge hook or something like that.
Well, and I will say if you point your Git editor towards VS Code, it has a pretty nice like rebase UI now that I've seen. I don't know if it was a plugin that I had or if it was VS Code Native. I don't know because I have GitLens. I don't know which one it was, but it had like a whole drop-down thing where I could like pick squash and pick edit from like a drop-down in my UI.
I think that's GitLens. That's and nice. It's nice.
Yeah, so that was pretty rad. I like that whole thing.
Yeah, like making those tools a little nicer and accessible regardless. Yeah, because maybe it's not a... The other controversial thing is if you reply, it's a skills issue, but maybe not necessarily. It's a knowledge issue, and then pick the tool that does
the
knowledge for you.
I do. You're right. You said it, and I glanced over it. I interactive rebase. If I have a long-running branch, and I have 10 commits in it, and I start getting conflicts and as I'm rebasing, and I'm like 5 in, and I know I have 5 more commits, I'm going to say, all right, let me stop what I'm doing. I'll kill this rebase. I'll abort it. And then I'll interactive rebase down to 1 commit and then rebase. And then it's like that was much easier to do than trying to continually edit conflicts through 10 or 15 or 20 commits. Just get it back down to 1 and then only rebase over 1 commit. And that's much easier.
Yeah, agreed. There you go. There's a pro tip for a listener.
yeah.
You rebase.
That's one of the big problems. Like, for if it's more than 50 commits or something, you can just be like, I'll just merge. Or like, you know, but you do that into your branch so that whenever you're actually merging to main, you're still rebasing and squashing, and it doesn't matter at the end of the day.
Food for thought, a couple of ways to skin a cat. For a bunch of front end folks, my next question will be a little more about how entrenched in our own tools and ideologies we are, which is, so I started with, will HTMX change the way we build apps?
Mm-hmm. I saw that.
Slightly loaded though.
I mean, it looks cool. I'll admit it's one of those like up and coming things, but I can't imagine the entire front end community giving up on whatever the thing they're on right now is, right? Like there's no way that at least in office that we're going to decide, oh, let's just get rid of the 20 million lines of React code that we have in our code base and switch to HTML. For the young and upcoming startup who has nothing to lose, I could see, you know, a case for an HTMX, or if you're in like a, you know, a smaller code base, even maybe not a startup, but, you know, I feel the same way about Svelte. I feel like Svelte is another really cool looking framework that I would love to try. I can't do it in my day-to-day work. If I have like a dashboard or something that I'm making that doesn't, it's like a one-off thing, maybe I could go that way and see it. But is it going to be some ground shifting thing? I don't think so yet. The jury is out.
No.
And
I mean, I could see that in the sense of like, if it ain't broke, don't try and fix it kind of thing. But we're...
Yeah.
You know, it is cyclical in a ways, though. You think about it, like the web applications inherently were initially server rendered, served, hence server, right? And that's kind of your experience. And then you look at this, when you mention it too, like transitions API, a bunch of new APIs coming to the browser to say, you know, HTML is a first class language, and there's some APIs here that'll just actually... And sure, I'm going to go ahead and say a language, even though it's a markup language, it still is a language. Maybe not a programming language. You mean, I don't know.
No, it is a programming language. Fight me. Yeah. Let's do it.
I would, but you're far away. And I'm lazy.
Yeah.
So just taking a look at our base tools and saying, let's relook at this and how much complexity do we need to add? But I think you have a good point there, is like, there's diminishing returns of things that are working just fine in saying, oh, yeah, let's do Gmail, but minus all the JavaScript that did all these things, right? Like what's the advantage? What's the thing there? Like they can afford it just fine. They can, you know, it's working. There's lots of users. Like what's the point? There is a lot of developer community that have invested in front end complexity, right? Like
for better or worse. I mean, it's for just better or worse, it is.
For whatever reasons, there's tons of complexity that exists there. And there's tons of tools that can change the complexity or shift it off to another direction or whatever else. It's going to be an interesting, I think, next 5 to 10 years.
Well, and I think the thing that a lot of people on the tweeters and all the things miss is like, you know, we've been doing this a long time and we've seen some stuff, right? Like we've had to fight the IE6 and Firefox and Chrome and Edge and all these things for years. You find all these new things all the time, but you know, you don't have the baggage that we have.
right. Like we fought all these things and finally got them where we want them. Are we going to abandon them? I don't know.
Yeah.
Well,
if I have an opportunity to do a side project or something, then maybe I could see an HTMX or whatever. But for me, I don't. I'll stick with React for a while. It's working pretty good.
Now you're supposed to say Angular, by the way.
Angular. Yes. Oh no, God. No,
I don't know.
I haven't touched Angular since I don't even remember 2013, maybe. I don't even,
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
That was a bad version.
1.3, I think. I don't know.
I jumped ahead to razzing you about Angular, but you know, I don't know.
I think all of the frameworks have really gotten pretty good, honestly. And like, I'm all for teaching people that HTML is a first class citizen, and like, just sprinkle in the JavaScript when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And then who cares what you use? Like,
yeah,
if you like React, fine. Like, if you don't, fine, use Svelte or whatever. Like, it doesn't matter as long as you're conscious of, you know, when do I actually need it? Because I feel like we went down a huge rabbit hole of like, let's do everything in JavaScript. We want CSS in JavaScript, HTML's in JavaScript, everything's in JavaScript. It's all JavaScript, but it doesn't need to be. No. I don't know about that.
Single page applications that are brochureware are weird, you know.
Yeah. There's no merit to me in bashing anybody's way of doing things, right? Like, that's the thing that I hate is such and such sucks and you shouldn't use it. It's just such a bullcrap sentiment, man. Like, people like the way that they do their thing, and you know, you should just hear what they have to say, no matter what that thing is. And everybody has their thing they like to build in, they're comfortable. And but I will say, like, I did change on that a lot. I remember back in when I was doing Backbone and people were doing other things, I used to be like, why wouldn't you just use anything but this one thing? But I've just learned over the years that, like, there's so many ways to solve problems on front-end web development. There's just no reason to go bashing anybody for anything. There's just so many different ways to solve problems. Just let people, you know, you can have an opinion and certainly talk about it and teach people your way of thinking, but don't bash other people. Like, don't be mean. Just be cool, man.
But don't you know that we live in an age of evangelizing things like to the degree of religion or sports or whatever else? Like, a long time ago, I used to be a bartender, and they used to say, like, a couple of things you never talk about at the bar are sports and religion and politics.
And
programming languages now, apparently, or whatever,
tabs,
you know?
Versus and, spaces.
Yeah, JS framework, tabs versus spaces. It's always spaces, though.
I'll go to the mattresses on that one.
Does
anyone still like tabs? Like, people that even say tabs really just mean I want tab to be a shortcut to like two or four spaces.
I just saw somebody talking about tabs on Twitter the other day, and I want to say it was Svelte. Something in Svelte was a tab. They were fans of tabs. I don't remember.
Oof.
I don't know.
Svelte's dead then.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a bad purchase decision. Sorry. Svelte's dead.
Oh, boy.
Cool.
Okay.
Well,
that was a lot of random shit. Go ahead.
Tech random things.
It was fun.
Okay. It's a nice segue. I know you wanted to talk about you've coined the term DevOps, and you're a part of your DevOps team at Microsoft,
OneJS
internally, but outwardly you talk about it as DevOps. So I want to know what's up with DevOps.
I've had this long journey, right, where it's like I did ColdFusion.net, then mostly JavaScript for like, you know, forever. And then I got into React and I was like, ooh, I like this thing. I don't know. React just felt nice. Like, I love JavaScript as a language. And it was the first time I was writing a UI thing that I was like, oh, I like this a lot. Like, this just sort of makes sense to me. It just feels like good. And then I built some cool stuff with it. You know, I was building infinite scrolling and server-side rendering. And this was React 15, before a lot of that was, you couldn't really do a lot of Googling or Googling with Bing for how to server-side render stuff, right? So I had to sort of discover that. And I was using Node, 10 or 12, server-side rendering React. And I was doing mostly UI development before that, right? Like, for my stint at Appentoo, I was doing all JavaScript stuff. And I made Lonely Planet cool things, and the designers, my friend Brad, made me push this pixel down over here a little bit or change that color to the wrong thing. And I started realizing, like, I don't care about pixels anymore. Like, I care about this cool server-side rendered app thing I just made and this component library I just made, so that, like, other developers can take both the component library I built and build other things with it. And also, I really got into this idea of, like, building, you know, the BFFs, the backends for front ends, with Node and server-side rendering my front end. That got me really excited. And, you know, I had at Lonely Planet, we had, 10 people or so. And I was the only person that really had sort of a bent towards, and maybe it was because of my time in ColdFusion and .NET before that, I had, like, this backend bent. So then I was like, I think I like building tools for my team to do their work better. I found that to be very rewarding. You know, they'd show up for work and I'd have some new tool that I built to be like, that's so much better now. That my day is going to be so much quicker now because you made that thing. And that's when I got the like, oh, this is my thing. JavaScript tooling is now my thing. I'm just a sadist, but I kind of like writing Webpack configs. Like I got to where I was like, I actually like knowing what this little knob on a Webpack config does versus that one, you know, all the different whatevers you could do in there. I got to love that stuff. Then after I went to Eventbrite and I was on a team, I didn't even realize that was a thing. I just sort of went to some conferences and somebody said, hey, you know, there's people that just do front-end tooling as a job. And I was like, really? That sounds cool. I kind of want to do that. And my friend Ben Alegbodu, Ben MVP, hooked me up with a gig at Eventbrite on the FE Infra team. And we were split doing our EB frameworks, our UI library, EDS, and doing FE Infra and front-end infrastructure. But it felt weird because all of a sudden our team was called front-end infrastructure. We were doing tooling, writing Webpack configs, and I worked with Jamie Kyle, Creative Lerna came and worked with us a little bit and taught us how to do monorepo stuff. And so I was suddenly writing Bash and doing Docker and doing things that normal front-end developers don't do, you know? Like, I'm not doing front-end development anymore, but I'm still called front-end infrastructure. This doesn't make sense. So, like, what am I? Kyle, my friend Kyle Welch, and I just sort of jokingly went to Twitter and said, what do we do? Well, who are we if we're front-end developers, but we're not writing JavaScript? And we got a lot of, like, you know, front-end DevOps or, you know, front-end infrastructure, front-end platform. And then this one guy said DevOps in angle brackets, and I was like, that's it.
You were like, that's it. That's I won. It.
Yeah, you won. Nice. Enrique, this guy on Twitter. So yeah, that's sort of the term I use internally to describe what we do. And it's this weird, you know, I'm a front-end developer, but I write back-end code. I do Node. I do Docker. I do Bash scripts, things that most front-end developers just take for granted. You know, I don't want the folks building Copilot in Word right now to have to worry about, you know, their Webpack startup times or their CI infrastructure. You know, I just want them to write, let's just build Copilot for Word, guys. Like, I'll take care of the rest of that stuff for you. You guys go do your stuff. And that's what DevOps is to me, is this whole, that whole idea.
So what about documentation? Do you do that?
I do. I write a lot of documentation as well. In fact, just like tweeted that I started doing this sort of DDD of documentation-driven design, where I try to write the README of a package before I write any lines of JavaScript. And I'm trying to coach my team on that as well. Another reason why I got into doing that was because in my borderline obsession with Microsoft for so many years, Scott Hanselman is a big C# guy underneath the cloud here at Microsoft. And he talked years ago about this idea of you have a limited number of keystrokes in your life, right? Until you don't have any more. And so he says, if somebody asks him a question at work, rather than just responding in Teams or Slack or whatever it was, he will write a blog post or a piece of documentation or a wiki and send them that link back. And then he has written down for himself and for that person and for anybody else, whoever happens to have that question, the answer. And it's then documented. So that's sort of my mantra here. And I do the same thing even videos. As you can see, I love like recording videos. So if somebody asks me a question or if I'm deep diving on something technical for people at work, I'll record a video and still maybe even write a little bit of docs too, but then put the link to the video in it and describe it that way. So yes, documentation is key in maintaining your infrastructure, your architecture as well.
I love that that's basically your cue that something should be documented that isn't.
Yeah.
Getting a question about it.
Yeah.
It seems like, oh, let me think about, would that make sense to document it once? And then, you know, that's been covered. It's interesting. This space has been named a number of things over the years. I remember going to a conference in 2014 and it was called Front End Ops. Yeah, there you go. Represent. I love your upgrade. And I guess for anyone listening to the audio, Jonathan also has a bottle of our Sagamore Rye barrel pick
so good.
And has shifted over. So that just goes to show you what he feels about it. But
shifted left
into a bottle of rye. And you will be shifting a little back and forth later when you leave your office.
That's right.
But that's okay. So yeah, this whole space of like tooling and methods of operating and support and all this thing, you know, it was just like ops existed for a long time. And then there's been like this focus on ops specifically for browser side rendered applications. It was called front end ops when I went to this conference. It's been called developer experience, platform engineering most recently. I do feel like that the lines are blurring more. And, you know, while it's a focus inherently at the end of the day, it is a support role where your customer is a developer, a product developer. And I almost feel like I was around at times where front-end developer was kind of looked down upon in ways. And I feel like, I almost feel like things like React and single-page applications and MVC front-ends and all this kind of crazy stuff is almost a reaction to that of like, oh yeah, hold my beer. I'll show you how shit gets real complicated.
Yeah.
And we can do it. And a lot of smart people figured that all out. So it's not a slight against anyone in that way. Mm-mm. But it just is like, it makes you start to think about like, we're all working on these things towards a mutual goal and solving problems in the ways that we know how with the tools that we think are best. But like, aren't we all just developers? And, you know, you're a front-end engineer. Are you? I mean, you're an engineer.
Yeah.
And your focuses are in a particular areas, right? So like, I almost think like these are all the same things that we're coining all these different things. And maybe it's necessary for, I don't know, you know, salary bands or whatever else bullshit thing is. But at the end of the day, you could write Cold Fusion at one point. You wrote .NET at one point. You can write Node. You can write React. You're an engineer and you can solve problems in the place, in the space that you're put and the problem that you're asked to solve.
That's right.
I think that's really all that is. It's just, anyway, that was just my blah, blah about that.
I
still get a little reactive when I hear front end, back end, front end, back end, front end, back end. You know, it's just sort of like, it's not even that anymore.
Yeah. The lines have been blurred for a long time on that. And I feel like I saw the term full stack developer coming up again on Twitter recently, which I thought sort of went away, but I guess it never did. Or
budget
something.
Cuts. That's what that is. You know what that is?
But I have strong opinions on full stack developer.
Yeah. Generalist is master of none, right?
It's full stack developer is a term coined by companies who want to pay one salary and get two developers. And you can't do that. Like, there's so much on just front-end tooling that you need to know for being a front-end developer that, like, trying to be a master of all of it, some people can do it, don't get me wrong, but I think, like, most of the time, it's like a startup without the budget, and they're like, oh, yeah, we need a full-stack dev. Okay, well, does that mean they're doing DevOps and back-end and front-end and whatever else, and, like,
maybe
SQL
I have a thought. Like, this just popped into my head, but maybe a full-stack developer is just, like, a senior developer, like, so, because I feel like at a certain point in your career, everybody's a full stack developer if they've been doing something long enough for like 10 years. Like, if you've been doing, if you've been writing front end code for 10 years and you don't know how back end works still, like, I would imagine you probably do. So maybe what they really want is they just want someone that kind of knows their way around both sides of the house. And like, that's just,
I would call that a hacker.
but then like, that interview is 8 rounds and includes like JavaScript problems and systems design and, you know, like everything in between. So, you know,
it's really just about how long you've been doing it and the skills you've picked up along the way. Maybe if you're just starting and you just came from, but even, is there anybody that's just only a front-end developer now? I mean, surely people know something about how their back-ends work.
I think that there are niches that are more about UI developers. I've seen like where there's been like UI developers, and they're closer to design or design systems, and then they get dangerous enough to implement some of their design systems.
I have seen that.
Like, implement the design in HTML and CSS, but you don't need to know JavaScript.
Right.
Maybe.
Nothing
so
becomes
I've seen
interactive.
Some of that.
Right. And I mean, there's certainly one of the questions I always ask when I'm interviewing people is, do you prefer the front end or the back end of the front end? Right. So like, you know, do you want to make the design systems and push things on there, or do you want to do, you know, the more stuff like I do, the back end of the front end? I can't remember where I heard that term, but I really like that term too, back end, or the back end of the front end.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do like that. I mean, like, understand, do you want to implement logic, or do you want it to work on the visuals and the design side?
Make a button.
Do you want to ship features? Yeah. Or help people ship features.
Yeah. It's about enablement, I think, you know, being empathetic towards your developers and helping make their lives better. That's my whole thing.
You know, especially like when you talk about things around accessibility, which I've often admitted that I'm still naive to so many layers of. I really like high level understand certain things that you should be doing, but I know I'm like 30% of what you really should be covering. And that's okay, because I don't really claim expertise there, and it's not. And so then, you know, that's another element of where you can understand that there's a lot of rules there that people really have to like dig into a bunch of knowledge around. And you want people to specialize in that.
Yeah.
Right.
I think specialization is great. In fact, my Corey House talked a lot about this. Like, he, when he first went into consulting, he had like his company name was like Front End Consulting or something. And he wasn't getting any leads. And then he changed to, he bought reactjsconsulting.com or something like that. And
there you
then
go.
He just, I mean, he's never been starved for business. Like, specializing is a good thing. And I think we should teach people that it's okay to specialize. And in fact, maybe it's a desirable trait to specialize. Not drive yourself so crazy trying to think you have to know everything.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and understand that you're not making a commitment for life. Like, specializing in something for a few years to really deeply understand it and then move to the next thing, that, again, is another sign of senior engineer, is to gain those experiences across the areas that you're most interested in.
Yeah,
and bringing that.
And you learn how to learn. I think that's the key there. If you've learned multiple things enough times, it's like, here's a new thing. I know how to learn. So I think I can figure out how to learn this thing. Like, that's how I feel about Rust right now. It's like, I really want to get into it. I've been hearing so much stuff about it. And that's like, I guess, where the front end tooling industry is moving, is like, let's just re-implement everything in Rust. And so I'm like, okay, debate that, I guess. But I do think it's cool. I think it's a thing that maybe could do some cool stuff. When we were just in a meeting the other day, and the developers that build the loop thing, Microsoft Loop, were telling me that they used Vite, or I think it was Vite, and they're transpiling like all of their repo from TypeScript to JavaScript in like 15 seconds using this new Rust-based tool. And I'm like, if you get everything from TypeScript to JavaScript in 15 seconds, then you could start bundling and like in type check in parallel, and like, that's a game changer. So like, bring on the Rust if it's gonna like transpile my whole, you know, million line repo in 15 seconds. Like,
yeah.
Okay, cool.
I mean, proof's in the pudding. I do think it's a fad that's being talked about a lot, but I think the fact that real things are getting made that are making real improvements, you have to take that seriously.
Yeah.
And so tooling seems to be a great place to implement that.
Yeah. And that's why I love tooling so much, is I just like experimenting with these new things that we're making and learning about all this new stuff. And our PR times are high, and I can't wait to make them not high anymore. Like, and then I will hear how excited people are when their PRs are now faster or CI is faster. That's all part of the things that get me excited to come to work every day now.
Yeah, Chuck's excited about that too. He likes YAML, so anytime he can work in CI/CD.
I like to be the antithesis of anything Robbie is interested in. So I just like latch onto that. He's like, oh, I don't like that. And I'm like, well, it's the greatest thing ever.
So, YAML.
Yet another markup language.
It's literally so funny to talk about YAML, because I joke all the time that I'm just a glorified YAML developer at this point, dealing with CI/CD systems. One of my items on my to-do list right now is to like figure out more coding tasks for the team I'm on, because we've just been stuck writing YAML for so long.
Oh,
I think of
Chuck's getting so excited.
Hire me.
Okay, let's do it. Yeah. Let's talk. The thing is, like,
I follow through on what we started 10 years ago. Okay.
Yes. Let's make it a thing. I want to treat YAML like they told us to treat controllers back in the day. It was like thin controllers and fat models, I think. I'm on this mission right now from God to decrease the amount of things I do in YAML and relocate those things into code. We had a release pipeline thing that was like about 200 lines of bash inside of a YAML template. And I was like, this is not okay. I know it started as like a few lines and it was like, okay, that's fine. And then it just kept growing and growing and growing. And so I recently took that 200 line bash script and converted it into TypeScript. And then I wrote like tests, and the bash script is like doing git checkout things and doing git tags and pushing to remotes. But because I rewrote it in TypeScript, I was able to mock the git call and make sure that it's like doing the right git calls. And I rewrote it as code, and it's been so nice because now I can refactor it. I can change it, and I understand our whole versioning flow. It's documented. It's got unit tests, the whole nine yards. So yeah, I am a big fan of thin YAML and fat logic, I guess. I don't know, but just don't write a lot of YAML.
Infrastructure is code, and then other things is code. Configuration is code, I think, can be.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, smart stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like we could go down that path for a long time, but I want to make sure you have some whatnot time too.
We have been rambling.
So here's our first big question around that. Yes. Is if you weren't in tech, what other career would you choose?
I'm a big fan of photography. I used to in college shoot second as the photojournalism photographer. And so while the main photographer was over there doing the bride and groom and the bridal party, I would just kind of be in the backgrounds with a big 70 to 200 zoom lens, just kind of getting shots from all over the place. We shot some really cool stuff together. One of the coolest was at the Nashville Zoo, and there was like an elephant behind the bride and groom, and I have this like really cool shot of like the bride and groom and an elephant behind. So I love photography. And I recently just bought a Canon R6 to start doing it again some more. I got to the point where I was like, oh, my iPhone's good enough to take pictures. You know, I was in that camp. And so for like 5 years, I just was like, oh, I'll just use this more. But then I took a picture. I had my father-in-law take a picture of my family at Disney in front of the castle. And he used portrait mode, of course, because you do. And then when I tried to put it on my desktop on my computer, I noticed the bokeh, the blur, was like cutting around my wife and my kid's hair. Ooh. And it looked horrible on a big screen. And I was like, ugh.
Yeah, large format, it's not as good as you think.
No.
But I'm in that camp as well. It's funny, because I started out as an architecture major, and then I went down the photography path and actually got into the Brooks Institute of Photography.
Nice.
But I couldn't afford it, so I didn't go. took a bunch of classes, whatever else, for a while, and then kind of faltered off later on. But it was my gateway into development, actually doing websites and stuff. Photoshop was how you built a website back in the day. That was a one-to-one. So I'm actually starting to follow your path a little more. We got these nice fancy cameras now, and I'm like, well, I've got a nice camera that can do more than just sit here.
Yeah,
I wonder if I should pick that up again.
Yeah
I love my full frame mirrorless camera, man. There is just nothing, especially like I've got my girls are, she just turned, one of them just turned 5 yesterday, the other is turning 9 in a few months. And being able to get these just amazing pictures of them. We went to London and Paris on a trip in May. And I mean, we have this incredible photo of my family with the Eiffel Tower behind us that my father-in-law shot with my camera. And I've got those for like a lifetime now. And that you could not have done what I did, what I had him do on my R6. There's no way my iPhone could have replicated.
Nice.
And so, yes, photography, hands down. That's my gig.
That's a good one.
Yeah, we are unfortunately kind of out of time here. So not a lot more whatnot. But is there anything major that we missed or anything you want to plug before we end?
Thanks for having me on. I mean, yeah, I think like the main thing I am searching for in my next, like, where am I at situation is I am doing big scale things on my team, and I want to find other opportunities to converse more with people that are also in the same boat. We're like, we're no longer in the 50 packages, 100 packages, couple thousand, 10,000 lines of code. We're in like the 2,000 packages, 10, 15 million lines of TypeScript world. And you can't really Google for problems like that very easily. They just, they don't exist.
Yeah, right.
So I'm trying to figure out the right way to go about like talking to more companies that, sometimes people hold the thing so close to the chest. And I'm like, we're all solving the same problems here at every different company, the bigger ones, you know, we're all solving the same problem, just a little bit different. Like, can we talk? How are you guys doing this like transpiling thing that, or this Webpack thing, or what are you all doing? Like, that's where I'm at. I want to learn.
And there's no IP there. So you need to start like the Mang group for support engineers or something. I don't know.
Yeah. That's where like the DevOps thing or whatever. I don't even care, man. Like I cheekishly call it DevOps. I don't even care. I just want to talk to people that build big stuff and figure out how to make building big stuff better.
Also, you have to let us know when your fitness course comes out. fitness for DevOps.
Yeah, I have thought about that a lot too. I got into that a while ago, and fitness to me is a mental health thing too, right? Like if I don't do something on a day-to-day basis, now I go crazy. Like I've got to go run or lift something heavy to just deal with life and everything. And it's just fun now. Like, and I'm just like, I have all these heavy things going on, but it's just part of my routine. I like the work of doing that and resetting my mind, getting it away from the keyboard for a little bit, here for 8 hours a day. And so I'd rather not eat a long lunch and go just eat at my desk and then take an hour and work out at 2 o'clock or whatever when there's no meetings.
Nice.
I could start. I don't know. We'll see. Dev, fitness, I don't know, something.
Thanks everyone for listening. If you liked it, please subscribe, leave us some ratings and reviews. We appreciate it, and we will catch you next time.